The first trial in the David Grunwald murder case is now in the hands of a Palmer jury. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the proposed oil and gas leasing plan for ANWR gets an icy reception from Alaska Natives in Fairbanks.
I do have hope and faith that the Alaska Natives are going to stand up and they're going to put a stop to this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The first trial as a result of the 2016 murder of Palmer teenager David Grunwald has gone to the jury. For the past 2 weeks, prosecutors have questioned witnesses and presented evidence in their case against Eric Allmendinger, one of several alleged accomplices who are all being tried separately. This week, Allmendinger's defense rested without calling any witnesses of its own, including the defendant himself. That set the stage for closing arguments today before the case went to jurors to deliberate. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove was in the Palmer court today and says the focus has been on whether Allmendinger was a willing participant in the murder or if he merely went along with the others because he was too scared to say no. Casey joins us now. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Lori. Yeah, this trial has not really hinged on whether Allmendinger actually pulled the trigger. It's more about, like you said, whether he was a willing participant and legally an accomplice with the others. And that means that he took steps, they say, to participate in this killing. The steps that the prosecutors laid out today in their closing arguments have been addressed throughout this trial, and that includes providing a gun that was used to beat David Grunwald. The fact that the camper that David was beaten in was Allmendinger's family's camper on his property, and that he also rode along with the others to where Grunwald was shot. He actually rode shotgun with his loaded gun. And then he also allegedly helped clean it up and lied about it. And those are things that his defense attorney does not dispute. But, of course, his intent, his state of mind is basically the big question in this whole trial.
Allmendinger's defense attorney, as we noted earlier, didn't present any witnesses, but what did he say in his closing arguments?
Well, Allmendinger's attorney, John Iannacone, says his client was too scared to not go along with the others. He says that the other accomplices are the ones to blame and that this was all about Grunwald, who had a good home, a girlfriend, a car, and other alleged accomplices having nothing, essentially being homeless with no prospects. And that they just sort of converged on Allmendinger's camper to smoke pot and hang out, and sort of alluded to those other accomplices, specifically Austin Barrett and Dominic Johnson, being sort of jealous of David Grunwald. That there's one thing about this trial that I think has really, that's one thing about this case that has really been hard for people to understand is what sort of a motive these guys might have had. And Iannacone there is sort of offering a possible motive, but basically also saying that this really came down to nothing. I mean, there was no real reason for this to have ever happened. There has been some evidence presented that these guys all sort of idealized gang culture, specifically Crips culture. The prosecutors showed pictures of them throwing gang signs and wearing all blue and talking about being Crips, but John Iannacone, again, Allmendinger's attorney, said in court today during his closing argument that all of that was just sort of them trying to look tough, that they were just playing dress up. And Allmendinger actually, the first time I've seen him show any emotion in court, he appeared to cry actually when Iannacone was saying this. And his attorney turned to him away from the jury as he's given this closing argument and said, this is not your family. These guys aren't your family. Your real family is your parents, your grandmother, and sort of making this point that he used to think that these are people that he would die for and that now, you know, they're all being tried separately. They're not in this together anymore.
When the arguments concluded and you were leaving the court room today, you had a chance to speak with David Grunwald's mom, Edie. What did she have to say?
I just asked her, you know, how is she getting the strength to do this? This maybe isn't going to be the only trial. There are others that are charged in this crime, and Almendinger is just one of them. And so I just asked her kind of how is she finding the strength to do this?
It's hard. It's really hard, but we've got a lot of support. And some times are harder than others, but I have confidence.
Casey, what are the charges the jury will be making decisions on?
Well, obviously, we've heard a lot about the murder charges. That includes first and second degree murder and all of the lesser charges that could be included in that if the jury doesn't find him guilty on murder one or murder two. That's manslaughter or criminally negligent homicide. The charges also include kidnapping, arson, evidence tampering, and assault. And also, I just want to point out, after the alternate jurors were removed today, just at the very end of things, the jury now is down to 8 women and 4 men, and they will most likely start deliberating tomorrow. That's Thursday.
That was Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reporting from the courthouse in Palmer. About 250 people turned out yesterday at a meeting in Fairbanks to offer comments on a federal plan to launch an oil and gas leasing program in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Most of those who showed up for the meeting at the Carlson Center oppose the plan because they say it would disrupt caribou calving season and harm native subsistence and culture and the environment. Backers of the plan say coastal plain development would boost Alaska's economy. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
84 people signed up to talk about the plan to open the coastal plain to oil and gas development, and by the time a half dozen of them had spoken, nearly 100 protesters showed up outside the Carlson Center to offer their public comments.
I do have hope and faith that the Alaska Natives are going to stand up and they're going to put a stop to this, because when it comes down to it, we're all going to be affected. Climate change, don't care if you're upriver or downriver. We're going to all live with the effects.
Bernadette Dementev is a Gwich'in from Fort Yukon, and she's executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee, which opposes development on the ecologically fragile coastal plain. Princess Desiree Johnson, the committee's former executive director, says members of the organization and the Fairbanks Climate Action Coalition came to tell federal officials presiding over the meeting that oil and gas exploration will harm the porcupine caribou herd and other wildlife that provides subsistence to native peoples.
I wouldn't be standing here today if it wasn't for that porcupine caribou herd. If it wasn't for the Cho, the king salmon.
Meanwhile, inside the Carlson, representatives from industry and labor and officials with the State Department of Natural Resources accentuated the positive. Kara Moriarty is executive director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and she says extracting the coastal plain's hydrocarbons could bring economic benefits like those that came from development of the North Slope and construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System.
It goes without saying that Alaska's economy relies heavily on the oil and gas industry. One-third of all jobs in the state of Alaska can be attributed back to the oil and gas industry.
John Hobson Jr. is the mayor of Wainwright and president of the North Slope Borough, and he says his community and others in the region depend on the industry.
Oil and gas property tax is what pays for our services when it comes to police and fire and schools and public works.
But Steve Guinness, the traditional chief of the Fort Yukon-based Gwich'aji Gwich'in tribal government, says federal officials should not proceed with developing an environmental impact statement, or EIS, for the lease sales because they haven't adequately invited public comment from residents of communities that would be most directly affected by coastal plain development.
I don't understand how the United States government and the Congress of the United States could shortcut a process to do what's going on here today.
Rhonda Pitka is chief of the Village of Beaver, and she says federal officials should double the 60-day public comment period for the EIS. She says the feds should stage more meetings in Gwich'in communities and talk directly with tribal government officials with an interpreter.
Our chiefs are requesting that you come and consult with us. I'm requesting government-to-government consultation in the Village of Beaver. I also sent in a letter requesting that the materials be translated to Gwich'in and that you also bring along translators.
Pitka also says the meetings should have been scheduled for later because many Gwich'in are away from their villages at fish camps preparing to harvest salmon.
Our tribal members right now are getting ready for our subsistence season. I am actually missing out on getting my grandma's fish camp ready.
But scheduling the meeting around hunting and fishing seasons can be tricky, says Joe Balash. He's a former state natural resources commissioner who now serves as an assistant secretary of the interior, and he was one of the seven federal officials presiding over the meeting.
The folks that live up on the North Slope who participate in the whaling season, you know, the spring season is more or less just concluded. There will be a fall season.
Balash says translating documents would be a new requirement that federal officials may want to consider, along with adjustments to the public comment hearings. The next scoping meeting will be held tonight in Anchorage, followed by another on Thursday in Ukiagvik. Public comments on the leasing program plan EIS are due by June 19th. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Southeast hospitals respond to Medicaid uncertainty.
We have less than 30 days cash in hand, and that's being very generous.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1950. And by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The state is running short on money for Medicaid. Until the next fiscal year starts in July, hospitals and other healthcare providers won't get paid for treating much of Alaska's low-income population. But as KSTK's June Leffler reports, the state is trying to funnel what money is left to hospitals that could otherwise shut down.
The state is $20 million short of what it needs to make Medicaid payments until July 1st. Some healthcare providers are getting paid, some aren't.
So we're prioritizing those smaller providers, or people who are the sole provider in their community, who are very reliant on Medicaid.
That's Shonda O'Brien of the Department of Health and Social Services.
We know that if we aren't able to continue to pay them, they would have to shut their doors. And we definitely don't want that to happen.
Wrangell Medical Center checks off those boxes. It's the only hospital in the island town. Most of its revenue comes from Medicaid, and it already has a hard time paying its bills.
We have less than 30 days cash at hand, and that's being very generous.
Aaron Angerman is the hospital's development coordinator.
Usually the numbers are floating around 9 to 15 days of cash at hand, meaning if all the money stopped coming in and we still have to pay payroll and pay the expenses, benefits, things like that, just to keep the lights on, that's how many days we could survive without getting more payments coming in.
Other rural hospitals like Petersburg Medical Center, Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center, and Sitka Community Hospital are also prioritized. The state will assess every week where it can and cannot pay based on need. This can keep small, struggling hospitals afloat for the next month.
For as long as we have cash on hand to continue doing that, that's what we're doing. As soon as the cash runs out, we won't have any options except for to wait and make payment on July 1st.
Once July hits, everyone will take a breather. But the folks at Wrangell Medical Center know the struggle does not end in July.
And as you can see at last year's numbers, we didn't have enough. So come next year, we're going to have the same issue.
Claims filed in June will be paid from next year's budget, which is already funded $30 million less than the governor requested.
That's the scary part to me, is like this is going to look the same next year, if not worse.
In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
A Fairbanks man has been charged with second-degree murder in the death of his infant child. Fairbanks police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says 22-year-old James Jimison brought the six-month-old girl to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital on May 11th.
Saying that the infant was unresponsive and was not eating. At that point, medical staff did a CAT scan, found extensive bleeding and swelling, and transported the infant to Providence.
The child died on May 15th. McCulloch says police interviewed Jimison and determined he was responsible for the baby's injuries.
The father stated that the child had fallen, the child had hit its head, and changed his story a few times. Then the father admitted that he shook the child.
Jimison told investigators that the shaking, including hitting the child's head against his own, an autopsy revealed six blunt force injuries to the infant's forehead. Halibut have hit the docks in Dillingham. The halibut fishery opened on May 1st, and the first landing was on May 14th. As of Friday, there were 8,700 pounds of halibut landed. This year's quota for Area 4E is about 34,000 pounds, less than last year's quota of just under 59,000. Gary Klein is the Regional Fisheries Director at Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, or BBEDC.
It is a reduction. It's basically because there appears to be less halibut abundance in the Pacific, not just in Area 4E, but stretching down to southeast and throughout the Bering Sea. And because of this concern, the regulatory agencies have adopted more restrictive catch limits for 2018.
Those regulatory agencies include the National Marine Fisheries Service, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and the International Pacific Halibut Commission. The decrease in halibut could stem from fishing efforts, competition for the same prey by other species such as the arrow-tooth flounder, and water temperature. In order to better understand the effects of water temperature, BBEDC implemented a regulation last year that requires halibut fishers to deploy a hobo temperature logger with their longline gear.
Basically, it's calibrated to take temperature every hour, and then we could set it at different intervals. The intent of it is to monitor the water temperature within Bristol Bay and to see if water temperature really correlates with halibut abundance and harvest rates within the region.
Klein does not expect this year's lower quota to negatively affect fishermen participating in the industry.
We do have some quota in Area 4D, which is further offshore, also known as the Northwestern Bering Sea. If our fleet catches the quota in 4E, essentially they could fish some of the quota we have in 4D.
Area 4E fishery participants must be verified residents of communities in the BBEDC community development quota. 10 fishermen are currently participating. That is fewer than applied to participate before the season began. So Klein expects that more may join the effort in the coming weeks. The fleet will likely continue fishing for halibut until commercial salmon fishing begins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside Alaska. And it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 1-800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
After 3 days, a 31-pound, 6-ounce Chinook leads the Sitka Salmon Derby. While the leader is excited to be in the money, he's also aware that should he hang on to his lead after two more days of fishing next weekend, this will be the smallest fish in 63 years to win Sitka's Derby. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Well, like many a leader after the first weekend in the two-weekend-long event, Pat Dotson is not giving anything away.
For a hint, I was very close to town.
Thanks for the tip, Pat. Just about everyone in the 63rd annual Sitka Salmon Derby was close to town as gusty winds and driving rains churned Sitka Sound into a frothy tempest. Dodson, who manages inventory for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium and who is a veteran of many derbies, said he settled into a protected spot and waited for the fish to bite. When he brought his king into the weigh station with just 20 minutes to spare on Memorial Day, he was surprised to learn that his 31-pound, 6-ounce Chinook was at the top of the leaderboard.
I don't think a fish that small has ever won the Derby, and I know they've been coming in, you know, smaller over the past couple of years. I'd really be surprised if that stayed.
But it might stay, and if it does, Dodson will win another $7,500 on top of the $500 for having the biggest fish on Monday. While everyone knows there are big fish out there, the biggest king ever to win the Sitka Derby weighed over 73 pounds, everyone also knows the 40 and 50 pounders are becoming scarcer. Although it seems counterintuitive, king salmon aren't getting smaller. Ed Jones, the Chinook Salmon Research Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says kings are getting younger.
But what's really driving that issue with Chinook salmon getting smaller is that there just aren't any older age fish anymore. They're coming back younger.
Jones made this presentation on May 21st in Sitka as part of the state's Chinook Salmon Symposium. It was an effort to bring everyone up to speed on the latest science and politics driving reductions in the Southeast king salmon harvest. Last year's Derby winner weighed 35 pounds, 6 ounces, likely a 5-year-old salmon that had been in salt water for 3 years, also known as a three-ocean fish. The 2016 winner weighed 40 pounds, 8 ounces, which until then was the smallest fish to win. Likely, it was also a three-ocean fish. From 1956 to 2014, Derby winners always tipped the scales in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 pounds and up. Likely, all the fish were at least 6 years old or four-ocean fish. Pat Dodson came in third a couple of dozen years ago for total poundage. He's seen the big fish come over the rail.
I also, when you're a kind of 49-pounder, but that year a 60-pounder won it. So, and I think the following year a 47-pounder went. So I wasn't too lucky that year. I think I came in 13th place with that 49-pounder.
Dodson fished all 3 days of the Memorial Day weekend despite the miserable weather, and he plans on fishing both days next weekend as well. Like all other Derby participants, he's not put off by this year's one-fish bag limit on the outer coast. The weather is probably a bigger factor, he says. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Dance groups, artists, canoe paddlers, and traditional food experts are gearing up for Celebration 2018. It's Southeast Alaska's largest native cultural gathering, held June 6th through the 9th at Centennial Hall in Alaska's capital city. It's been happening every other year since 1982. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on some of the traditions as well as what's new.
It can be hard to fully describe Celebration. You can talk about its 2,000 or so dancers, or its 5,000 participants, or the language, the oral traditions, and the regalia. But that just doesn't fully capture the experience. So I asked Rosita Worrell, president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which puts on the 4-day event. She described 1 year's grand exit when all the groups dance out of the performance hall.
And it was like we were one people, one being, and we were all dancing. And it reminded me of a swarm of fish coming in, but everybody was just kind of in unison. There was this kind of like this, we were part of a whole spiritual essence.
Celebration 2018 lists 45 dance groups from Southeast Alaska, the Yukon, British Columbia, the Pacific Northwest, and California. Every celebration has a lead dance group representing a clan, but this year it has two.
The Shangukwedi, or the Thunderbirds, and the Hlukakadi, or the Sockeye.
They're from Haines and Klukwan, or the Chilkat and Chilkoot areas. Worrell says they're interrelated and will dance together with clan songs from each. Here's clan leader David Kantsik with the Thunderbird trade song.
Hey, Natsuchiya, hey, Natsuchiya, hey, Natsuchiya, hey, Natsuchiya, hey, Natsuchiya.
The Grand Exit will use another trade song, one the clan bartered for with inland Athabascan tribes. Not all of the dance groups are made up of clan members. Others are community, school, or multi-tribal based. Celebration coordinator Carmelita Estrada says she's enjoyed the growth of the youth groups. She says a few years ago, two younger cousins from Angoon formed their own dance troupe. They'll be part of their second celebration this time around.
We would never have thought to start our own dance group, you know, and so to be able to see people even younger than me taking that initiative, you know, we have young girls in our group who are still in elementary school and they're writing songs. They're writing, you know, Tlingit songs. And so just to see that from my own community is really, you know, inspirational, really, like, for me, it raises the bar.
Regalia, from clan hats to vests to button blankets, is worn by most dancers. But Whirl says that's changing.
Before, we would only allow traditional regalia, but we kept saying if our culture is going to evolve, then we have to, you know, let it and support that. So now you're seeing a lot more native wear, native fashion wear.
This year's celebration will continue the relatively new tradition of a runway-style fashion show. But for the first time, the models will have a formal training session. Another new event is a seal oil contest to be judged by taste and other factors. Estrada says such contests will be more visible than in previous years.
We would do that kind of off to the side in the elders' room, and it wasn't as prominent as it's going to be this year. So not only are we adding the seal oil competition to that, so now there's three food categories, but we're also moving that to the main stage.
This year's celebration also includes a juried art show, a youth art show, a regalia care workshop, a native artists market, and the ever-popular toddler regalia review. But the action isn't all on stage. Estrada thinks back to celebrations she attended as a child.
You know, you remember running around with your cousins and you don't really realize how important and how lucky you are and what a profound event you're at. And so a lot, and but those things are just as fun, you know, being able to reconnect with family and friends from all over.
Each celebration has a theme. For 2018, it's respect, weigh your words. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Palmer, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross and Fairbanks, June Leffler and Wrangell, Izzy Ross and Dillingham, Robert Woolsey and Sitka, Abby Collins and Haynes, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal summer routes now available to Cordova, Anchorage, and Valdez. Information available at flyraven.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.